Good to be back with you this afternoon. As Kurt mentioned, with the title Miserable Comforters, some of you can perhaps guess what our subject matter is in our first session. It is indeed the terrible bedding that you can buy at Bed Bath & Beyond, Miserable Comforters. Oh, the jokes just get worse from here. Because we're dealing with such a sensitive subject, I want to open up with an inappropriate joke. There was a gentleman in the congregation where my dad used to preach when I was a little boy, and his name was Brother Williams. And he was in his late 80s, in very good health. My dad went to visit him one day, and as he was talking to him, he said, Brother Williams, what do you think has been the secret to your long life, your longevity? Why do you think you've been in such great health all of these years? And Dad was expecting him to say something along the lines of, well, you know, I've always tried to live a good life before God, or I was faithful, or I honored my father and mother and the like. But Brother Williams motioned for my dad to lean in closer, and he said, every morning when I wake up, the first thing that I do is I eat a bowl of oatmeal, and I put a teaspoon of gunpowder in my oatmeal. And he was convinced that this was the secret to his long life. And my dad thought, what in the world? A couple of months later, Brother Williams passed away. And my dad was reading the obituary about his life. Said that he had been preceded in death by his parents, a wife. But that he had left behind three children, 12 grandchildren, 22 great-grandchildren, and an 18-foot hole in the crematorium. Oh, miserable comforters. In the story of Job, we find at the end of chapter 2 that Job's three friends come to comfort him. And the text says at the end of chapter 2 that they came and they sat with him and they did not open their mouth for 7 days. And in that way, his three friends were quite faithful. But then after a week had gone by, they made the mistake of opening their fat mouth, and it just went downhill from there. When you open up the book of Job and you read through the cycle of speeches, it can become kind of dense or a little bit disorienting as to what exactly is going on. But Job's three friends are essentially trying to convince him of the fact that he has sinned in some great way, and that is why all of this calamity has fallen upon him. And they are trying to comfort him by bringing him back to the Lord. Many in that time period, many throughout the entire Bible, the times of the Bible, believed in what is often called retribution theology, that if you do bad things will happen to you. If you do good things will happen to you. It is a form of Christian karma, if you will. And certainly we don't necessarily believe that today in terms of death, but we do hold to that idea in other arenas of life. And I've used this analogy several times in the past. Let's say that you're pumping gas somewhere. Let's say it's late at night and someone comes up to you asking you for some help. They're asking you for some money. Let's say their clothes are very disheveled. It's very clear they have not washed their clothes in a very long time. They have a very unkempt beard. It's clear they have not had a shower in a long time. There are some of us, and I'm not necessarily making a judgment call on this, but there are some of us who would, at least in our minds, think to ourselves, what poor choices have you made in life that have brought you to this place or to this station in which you're asking people at a gas station for monetary handouts? Again, that kind of thinking, right or wrong, that kind of thinking is retribution theology. It's the same idea that Job's three friends were engaged in. And when you open up the book of Job, here's what some of the things they're saying to him. For instance, his first friend, Eliphaz the Temanite, says to Job such things such as, you need to appeal to God and admit your offense. You need to recognize your guilt by comparing how God treats the wicked to how he is treating you and draw the inevitable conclusions. He says things such as, you need to repent and be restored. Bildad the Shuhite says to Job, you need to take the retribution principle seriously and recognize the inevitable conclusion. Again, if you're suffering bad things, it's because you have done bad things. You need to give up the pretense. The wicked are doomed and you are among those who do not know God. Later he says you need to face the fact that tradition knows best. Again, the tradition of the retributive principle. And then Zophar the Naamathite has to say to Job, he says, you need to devote your heart to God and put away your sin. Your sin is pride, and God has judged you as wicked. It is sadly the case that so often when we grieve, when we hurt, people say very inappropriate and very hurtful things to us. And this is my favorite session of all of the sessions in this grief seminar, because I finally, after many years, get to take revenge on all the people that have said stupid things to me when I have lost a loved one. I have to say that I am a big fan of revenge. I'm a big fan of revenge. I highly recommend it. Big fan of revenge. I'm finally going to get to take revenge on all the people that have said stupid things to me over the years. A couple of things that I want to mention as we get started. Let's talk about what not to say or do to a grieving person. I want you to recognize, first of all, that the compulsion to say something is very real, and you need to fight that feeling. And I've done this very often. Raise your hand. How many of you have ever been standing in line, maybe at visitation or at the funeral home or the like? So I've noticed that funeral traditions are a little bit different across the country. Do y'all have the tradition where at the end of a funeral, everybody gets in line and makes a final pass by the casket and then greets the family and then goes on? Do y'all do that around here? I know they do that in Texas, but sometimes, okay. I've seen it in Texas. I haven't seen it outside of Texas. We didn't do that in Tennessee and Mississippi and Alabama. But have any of you ever been standing in the line at the visitation or the funeral? And as you're standing in line, you are in the back of your mind trying to come up with what you're going to say to the family when it comes your turn. Any of you ever done that? I mean, okay. So what I want you to think about, or what I want you to realize right now is this. I have heard just about everything. Now, just when I think I've heard everything, somebody comes along and says something even dumber than the stuff I'd heard previously. But I think I've heard just about every dumb thing that a person could say when it comes to a loss or a death. And I am completely aware that very seldom can you say anything that's going to make anyone feel any better. But even with that experience and even with that knowledge, even I feel a profound compulsion to say something. Does that make sense? So even based on experience and knowledge, even I feel that compulsion. And so if I feel that compulsion, you probably feel that compulsion to say something. But what I need you to recognize is that you need to fight the feeling to say something. You need to fight that with everything that you can. And so as we think about that, number one, you do not need to attempt to rationalize the loss when you're talking to someone who is grieving. Do not attempt to rationalize. This can be seen in things such as, well, God looked out on his garden one day in heaven and it wasn't as beautiful as he wanted it to be. And so he needed another flower for his garden, and that's why God took your loved one. About a year ago, I was preaching on the Gulf Coast of Alabama at a congregation, and in the sermon I had talked about losing my son, and as we were singing the final song of the worship service, a lady came down front and stood on the very front pew right next to me. I mean, she's standing right next to me. I'm already thinking, okay, this is a little bit too close for comfort. I mean, she's standing right next to me. It's like we're on a crowded elevator right next to me. Did I happen to mention she's standing right next to me? She's standing right next to me. And I don't mean to be ugly. This isn't some senile old woman. She looks to be probably in her late 50s at the youngest, probably mid 60s at the oldest. She's not that old. And she's standing right next to me. I assumed that she perhaps had lost a child as well, and she wanted to share something with me as soon as we said amen. Or she had lost some other loved one. She had a story to tell. This happens very often. People hear that I've lost a child, and if they are in a similar situation, they want to share something. I thought maybe she had to get out the door very quickly, and she wanted to be sure that she was the first one to speak to me as soon as amen was said. As soon as the final prayer had been said, she turned to me and she said this: "The Lord has revealed to me that he knew something horrible was going to happen to your little boy one day. And that's why God took him." And it took all of the propriety and respect that my mama and grandmama had taught me not to say, "The Lord has revealed to me that you're an idiot." That's what I wanted to say. I didn't say that, but that's what I wanted to say. Again, you need to absolutely resist the urge to rationalize why this loss has occurred. Because at the end of the day, you don't know and I don't know. Even if we know exactly why from a from a real world standpoint why these things have happened. You know, a person went out and drank too much alcohol and got in a car and started driving and there was an accident, and that's why your loved one was taken, is because someone made a bad decision concerning alcohol, you know, something like along those lines. Even when we know from a real world standpoint exactly why this loss has occurred, you still don't know in the grander scheme or in heaven, in the realm that we're not aware of, the realm that Job was never aware of. Remember, Job lives and dies, never knows what happens in Job chapters 1 and 2 with the thing with Satan. Again, we have no idea what has gone on in that other realm that we are not privy to. We have no idea, and so we should not be speculating. Again, we need to resist the urge to rationalize. Does this make sense to everybody? Do not make the attempt to rationalize. You are not going to help anyone. I can almost promise you are going to be wrong. Number two, do not attempt to compare. Do not attempt to compare. As I mentioned this morning, the cardinal commandment of grief recovery is thou shalt not compare losses. Thou shalt not compare losses. This was something that was very difficult for my wife. And on the one hand, yes, I understand that losses are different. Let me back up. I understand that our society very easily assigns a level of severity to types of losses. For example, it is popularly thought that losing a child is worse than losing a parent, okay? Losing a spouse is worse than losing a friend. That's the general assignment that society gives. When our son passed away, my wife had a very hard time in group grief counseling because a lot of people that were in the group had lost a parent or a spouse. We were the only ones in there that had lost a child, and she did not do well because she's sitting there going, well, you're supposed to bury your parents. You're not supposed to bury your children. And so she had a hard time jiving well with grief counseling, with group counseling. But I'm telling you, the cardinal rule is you cannot compare losses. You just can't. It doesn't help anybody at all that's involved. You just cannot compare losses. And I have seen people try to do this in comforting a loved one or a friend. I have actually heard one woman use this phrase to a brand new widow. She used these words. She said, and I quote, I was standing there when she said it. I know just how you feel. Talking about the lady just lost her husband. I know just how you feel. My dog died last week. And you want to ask the funeral home director, do you have anything hard that I can hit this person with? I mean, something. Again, losing a parent is not the same as losing a child. Losing a spouse is not the same as losing a friend. You cannot compare losses. And then this is very important. Even if it is the same loss, again, you've lost a child, I've lost a child, you've lost a parent, I've lost a parent. Even if it is the same loss, the relationship and its dynamics were different, as well as your emotional makeup. No two snowflakes are alike. No two people grieve in exactly the same way. When I talk with people that have lost a parent or a child, I am very quick to remind them, I don't know exactly how you feel, but I know enough to know that this stinks and I'm very sorry. Again, oftentimes if they already know my story, they know that I have a little bit of a window into what they're feeling. But I make it very clear to them, I don't know exactly how you feel, but I know enough to know that this is a terrible thing and I'm so very sorry. Even if it's the exact same loss, you've lost a parent, you've lost a dad, I've lost a dad, you've lost a beloved dad, I've lost a beloved dad. Even if it is the exact same loss, again, the relationships were different, your emotional makeup is different, these things are not the same. So do not attempt to compare losses in any way. Number three, do not attempt to soften the blow. Do not attempt to soften the blow. When our son passed away, an older couple came to the funeral home and told my wife this, and I quote, you know, when you look at the way this country is headed morally, it's probably a good thing that he went ahead and died. What? I still don't know what they were thinking when they said that. But sometimes we unintentionally branch into the same area when we say something as seemingly inane or innocuous as, well, would you have really wanted them to suffer or have been in pain any longer? Would you have wanted them to go on suffering like they were? I know what we mean by that, and usually the people that are grieving know what we mean by that, but that can perhaps be hurtful. You need to resist the urge to soften the blow of what has happened, because at the end of the day, a person has died. That's not a blow that can be softened. It's not a blow that should be softened. And so we need to be sensitive to that. Something else we need to be sensitive to: do not attempt to correct their theology. Do not attempt to correct their theology. This applies to their thinking, their beliefs about heaven or hell, paradise, Sheol, Tartarus, about the eternal destination of the departed, of why bad things happen to good people, why God allows evil and suffering in the world. I think that there perhaps is a time and place for that conversation, but the funeral home is not one of those places, or the hospital, the emergency room, is not one of those places. I personally believe that the Bible is not exactly clear-cut on what exactly happens to the soul when we die. In other words, I subscribe to the basic plot that we're going to be living our lives, and then suddenly one day, whether quickly or just a little over a slow decline, one of these days, though, we're going to die. And at some point after that, Christ is going to return, and the dead in Christ will rise first, and then the rest of us who are still alive at that point rise to meet him in the air. And then we go up to the throne, and there's a judgment. And I don't know exactly how the final judgment is going to work. I don't know if it is an instantaneous judgment for everybody, or if it's like a take a number system. Now serving 6,432, I don't know exactly how it works. But the righteous go to heaven and the wicked go to hell. Okay, I subscribe to that basic plot. But what exactly happens to the soul after we die and before the second coming? I don't know that the Bible is entirely clear-cut on that. Does the soul simply fall asleep? Is there a holding tank for the righteous and then another holding tank for the wicked? Is there a morally neutral holding tank that everybody goes to? Do you go directly to heaven or directly to hell in some sort of curve of the time-space continuum? Again, I'm not entirely sure, because I can marshal up verses to support every one of those theories. And I also know this, that over the last 2,000 years, some really smart people, some very smart people, people that are way smarter than I am. I tell people, look, I'm from Mississippi and I was homeschooled. Manage your expectations. But I mean, people that are a lot smarter than I am have disagreed on this subject. So I don't think the Bible is entirely clear-cut on what happens to the soul when we die. I just know that at some point after we die, Christ will return, there will be judgment, and then eternity forever and ever and ever. And so I don't see the need to correct people's theology. I don't see the need to speculate on a person's eternal destination. Again, I don't see the need to preach someone into hell. Usually if they were a scumbag, the family knows they were a scumbag and they don't need me piling on. That's not necessary for me to do. I don't feel the need to speculate as to why bad things happen to good people. Again, there's a time and place for these conversations. The funeral home, the emergency room, the hospital, that is not the time and that is not the place. I have a good friend of mine who preaches in Mississippi. And a little less than 2 years ago, his father passed away. His father was an elder in the church, very beloved. This guy is a good friend of mine. The following Father's Day, I think his dad passed away around August or September. The following Father's Day, he was preaching at his congregation and made the comment, something along the lines, something very innocuous about, he either said something along the lines of, I can't wait to get to heaven and see my dad, or he said something along the lines of, I know that my dad looks down on me from heaven and loves me and is rooting for me. He said something along those lines. A gentleman came out of the auditorium at the end of services, came out of the auditorium and looked him in the eye and said, now you know good and well that we're not going to recognize one another in heaven, and you know good and well your dad can't see you from heaven right now, and walked off. What possible good did it do to say that? Think about it this way. It is very common for us to make statements that aren't necessarily indicative of what we actually believe concerning the afterlife. Case in point, I might, in passing, refer to St. Peter at the pearly gate doing such and this. when in reality, I do not believe that Peter is at the gate of heaven letting people in and out and so forth and so on and so forth. It's just it's a vehicle, it's a device, it's a metaphor that we use to say something else. I do not think that it is appropriate for us to try and correct people's theology in various situations, and so you need to resist the urge to do that. Finally, do not resist the urge to cheer them up. Resist the urge to cheer them up. Instead of trying to cheer them up, ask them to disclose, not deny, their feelings, especially during the denial or the anger stage. And then also invite that person to open up during the bargaining and depression stage. Ask them to open up, but be prepared for it to be very messy. One of the things that I've noticed doing these seminars, and I've talked with people and they've affirmed this, when we call someone in the aftermath of a loss and we ask them how they're doing, very seldom do we really want to know exactly all that they are feeling and how they're really, really doing. Now, we won't come out right and say, yeah, no, I don't really want to know the right answer. But there's a part of us that if they start going on and on and on, we're like, okay, how do I extricate myself from this very awkward situation? Maybe you've had very close family members or friends who have lost a loved one, and it was really hard to be around them because it was messy. I mean, emotions were flying all over the place. It was really hard to be around them. And then, and this is when I'll ask for a head shake here, how many of you have lost a loved one? Maybe a few weeks later, someone called you and asked you how are you doing? Or maybe you saw someone in public somewhere, maybe at church, they asked you how you're doing. And you resisted giving them the honest answer. You didn't lie, but you resisted giving them the complete disclosure, honest answer, because you knew that just wasn't, quote, proper or polite. Your mama had taught you better. How many of you have resisted doing that? Raise your hands. Someone asked you how you're doing, and you're just like, yeah, I'm not going to give you the full story because that's just not proper. My mama or my grandmama raised me better, okay? Again, there is something within us that I'm just not going to go there because that's not proper. I understand that. I really do. I understand that hesitancy because sometimes you've kind of dumped on somebody, and you saw their eyes get really big. They glassed over, and you're like, well, that was a mistake, or I might have damaged that relationship because I was a little bit too honest in that moment. When I call someone or when I see someone and I ask them, tell me how you're doing, I will often follow that up very quickly with, and I want to know the real answer. Usually they know my story. They know what I have been through. They know that I want to know the honest answer that I would not be asking if I did not want to know. And again, sometimes they might say, well, I'm doing okay, and they leave it at that. But I'm always hoping they know that I am sincere in my invitation to them to open up, to disclose how they are feeling. I don't want the pet answer or the nice answer, the considerate answer. I want the real answer, because it's always important that when we're going through the grief stage, it's always important for us to have that person that we can open up to and feel like I can say anything to this person at all, and I know that the relationship is going to be just fine at the end of the day. Those people are always very, very special. Don't attempt to cheer them up. When our son passed away, there was a couple that insisted on coming over to our house about 3 or 4 weeks later. We did not know them very well. I did not know the wife at all. My wife did not know them at all. I knew the husband a little bit because he was a preacher. They had 3 children. They all came over to our house, and they insisted on doing chores around the house, cleaning the kitchen and vacuuming and all these other things. And it was nice, but when someone you don't know at all insists on coming into your house and doing all these chores, that was just a little off-putting. I mean, and they didn't even ask permission. They just came in and they did it. That was just, and they said, the guy said to me, he said, well, we just came over to cheer y'all up. I don't want to be cheered up. I want to be miserable. I don't want to be cheered up. I just buried my kid. I don't want to be cheered up. Again, you have to resist that urge because, again, it's almost like you're trivializing the loss. It's like saying, well, you know, I know you're bummed out because your girlfriend broke up with you, so I'm here to cheer you up. I don't want to be cheered up. Again, we need to resist that urge. Finally, do not expect them to process their anger too quickly. Do not expect them to process their anger too quickly. If you do this, you will risk alienating them. If you come in to someone and expect them to get over their anger, whatever form it has taken, if you expect them to get over that too quickly, you are going to run the real risk of alienating them. What I have found in Scripture is that God is infinitely patient with us at this stage. If you look at the story in 1 Kings chapter 19, Elijah is very devastated over some things that have happened. He is not in a good place. He's very bitter. He's very angry. And the Bible says that God came and spoke to him in a still, small voice. Throughout the passage, God keeps asking his prophet this one question. What are you doing here, Elijah? What are you doing here, Elijah? God was very patient with his prophet in the midst of Elijah's anger. And so I think it's important that we not expect people to deal with their anger too quickly. What I ultimately want you to understand is that actions and presence will speak more and mean more than words. Actions and presence will speak more and mean more than words. When I was in college, I interned with a preacher in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And when it came to going to the funeral home, to a funeral, dealing with families that have lost a loved one, you know, families in the congregation, he told me something I will never forget for the rest of my life. He said this. He said, people may not remember if you were there. Talking about a funeral, a visitation, a graveside. He said, people may not remember if you were there, but they will remember if you were not there. And I thought, oh, how true. When my dad passed away, I can't tell you how heartwarming it was to see, both at the funeral home for the visitation and then later in the church building at his funeral. It was so heartwarming to see so many of my friends from Freed Hardeman who had made the drive down to attend one or the other. I mean, that really meant a lot to me. There was a young lady that she and I had been freshmen together at Freed Hardeman. We had had several classes together. After our sophomore year, she had moved to Auburn, to go to Auburn to finish her degree in nursing. And she had been dating a guy ever since high school, and they had gotten married. I had been to their wedding. She made the drive all the way from Auburn, Alabama to Baldwin, Mississippi, just to sit in the audience for my dad's funeral. I had no idea she was coming, but she made the drive, and to see her face in the audience when I got up to speak, that was incredibly encouraging. Same thing happened when my son died. I remember walking into the auditorium for the funeral that Friday morning and seeing the faces of a preacher and his wife. They lived in Charleston, South Carolina. They had made the decision to come all the way to Dallas for the funeral. They had flown, I gotta tell you, flying at the last minute from Charleston, South Carolina to Dallas, Texas at the last minute on a preacher's salary. Ain't exactly cheap. They had done it. His wife was about 6 months pregnant at the time, and I knew that had been an issue for them as well. I can't tell you how meaningful that was to me. I'd run through a brick wall for that guy now. I'm telling you, I would. As opposed to some people that I thought I was very close with, they later told me, well, we didn't come because we knew that there'd be so many other people there and we wouldn't get a chance to talk to you, and so we just decided not to come because we wouldn't get a chance to see you. I gotta tell you, that hurt. That hurt, and I eventually found it possible to forgive them, but that was very painful to hear. Whereas my wife and I later, after the funeral, went back and looked at the register the people had signed, both at the visitation and the funeral. We saw names in there of people that we had never seen at the visitation or the funeral, but they had signed the register. It meant that they were there, and I'm telling you, we were so touched. We couldn't believe that they had come. We were so touched. Again, people may not remember if you were there, but they will remember if you were not there. And so remember that actions and presence will speak more and mean more than words. So the million-dollar question is, what can I safely say, right? When you go to the funeral home, what can I safely say and know pretty much 100% of the time I'm okay? Because there is that compulsion to say something. Number one, I give you permission to say, I love you. You can't go wrong with I love you. Just tell me how much you love me. Just tell me how much you love me. You can also tell me how ridiculously good looking I am, but just tell me how much you love me. And then number two, you can say, I'm so sorry. When you go to the funeral home, when you're trying to comfort someone who's hurting, I give you permission to say, I love you and I'm sorry. If you go any farther beyond that, you have likely gone round the bend. You have gone off the reservation. You are likely going to say something that is deeply hurtful or insulting. You can say these two things and almost be okay 100% of the time. But then there's the question, what can I safely do? What can I safely do? Number one, make sure that you're present at the visitation, the funeral, and or the graveside. Again, they may not remember that you were there, but they will remember if you were not there. Always go out of your way to be present at the visitation, the funeral, or the graveside. The end of May, I got a call. I was in Oregon at the time, but I got a call from a good friend down in Bowie, Texas, where we used to preach. And he had told me that his grandfather had passed away. His father had been an elder. His grandfather had been a former elder. Wonderful family. Brother Bob was a remarkable man. He had not been in very good health for like the last 6 or 7 years. I did not know that he was in such bad shape, but I wasn't entirely surprised by the fact that he had passed. I knew that this was Thursday night. The funeral was going to be on Sunday. I'm in Oregon. I knew that there was no way that I could get home. But I called my wife and I told her that Brother Bob had passed. And I pleaded with her. You know, she's at home by herself with two girls. But I pleaded with her, please, please, please do anything you can to go either to the visitation or to the funeral. You know that they have meant so much to us. This family is very special to us. Somebody named Whitworth needs to be there representing the family. Please do everything. She said, absolutely. And she went for the visitation and was very glad that she did so. Again, this family just was very meaningful to us. I wanted someone from our family there. You know, they knew I was out of town. They knew I couldn't come. But I wanted to make sure someone from our family was there to represent and say those words, we love you and we are so sorry. Again, being present is such a big deal when it comes to these types of things. Make sure that you can go to either the visitation or the funeral or the graveside. I know in certain parts of the country, unless it is said otherwise, the graveside is usually just a family or invitation-only affair. What's the common tradition here? Is the graveside understood to be open to everybody unless otherwise said, or is it understood to only be open to family or unless otherwise stated?
Okay. I've seen both, Michael, but typically the family will make that announcement.
Okay, okay.
Invitation only or everybody's invited.
Yeah.
I've seen both ways.
Yeah. The biggest thing is make sure you sign the register. And I'm not talking about sign the register and then you can leave. I'm not talking about that. But I'm telling you, the family will go back and read that register. And when they see your name, that's going to be a big deal. If they never got a chance to see you, you never got a chance to see them. The fact that they see your name on the register, that is going to be a big, big, big deal. And so try to be present if at all possible. Another one, bring food, but ask first and then bring it and leave. Several months ago, I reached out on social media and asked people to share with me some of the things that they thought were helpful in the aftermath of a loss. What are some things that people can safely do? And this is something that they mentioned because so often it is the case that when there is a loss, people are deluged with food. I mean, everybody and their dog brings food over to the house. Now, I don't know how it is necessarily here. This might be something that's only true in the South. But is there a lot of food brought to the home in this area when there's a loss? Okay. I remember when Daniel died, we had so much food brought to the house. I mean, we were throwing stuff out. There was no way we could have ever eaten that much food. And so what a lot of people said was bring food, but ask first. In other words, make sure that food is needed. Because oftentimes what you'll hear is, well, that's really sweet of you, but we've got plenty of food. What I would recommend is waiting 2 or 3 weeks when two things have happened. One, people have stopped bringing food. And two, the reality of the loss has really slammed home, all right? The denial stage has kind of worn off a little bit. And that's the time when they don't have any energy whatsoever to prepare meals or grocery shop or cook or the like, or go out and grab takeout or something of that nature. 2 to 3 weeks after the loss might be the prime time to offer to bring them food. But then also they said, bring it and then leave. Because what often happens is we use, I'm going to bring you food, we use that as an excuse to come into the home and then stay a long time when we might be an unwelcome guest. Does that make sense? Again, people use that to kind of presume upon the family and overstay their welcome. Bring it. They said, bring the food and then leave. You just, you know, walk in and say, I wanted you to have this. You're still in our prayers. We are so sorry. We love you. I hope you enjoy this meal. If there's anything else I can do, please let me know. And God bless you. And then leave. So bring it and then leave. Another one, and this is a big deal, ask if you can run errands for the family, such as taking clothes to the dry cleaners or having their car cleaned or detailed. Maybe even offer to drive people to or from the funeral home or the cemetery. When Daniel died, the last thing that I wanted to do was to fight traffic. in the Dallas area. And so Jeff Jenkins drove us around to the funeral home, to the cemetery, for us to make the 1,001 arrangements that needed to be done. And that was so incredibly helpful. You're going to have people that they've got a really nice suit or a really nice dress that is for funerals and this and the like. It hasn't been gotten out in a long time and needs to be taken to the cleaners. Little things like that can go a long, long way. Send a handwritten, and I want to stress that handwritten, note, card, or letter. These are going to be cherished for years to come. When my dad passed away, I got a note in the campus mail there at Freed Hardeman from a good friend of mine. He had handwritten it on single-spaced notebook paper with a pencil. And I still have that letter. It's one of my most cherished possessions. It's talking about how much he appreciated our friendship and how much he loved me and how sorry he was that my dad had passed away. It was very, very, very meaningful. When our son passed away, my wife told me that the person who won the award for best card was the lady who taught our son on Wednesday nights in Bible class. And she had written a card to my wife from one mom to the next, just saying how sweet Daniel was and how much of a joy he was to have in class, how smart he was, how impressed she was with how polite he was. Just went on all the things a grieving mama wants to hear about her child. She had written that card, and that was very meaningful to Sarah. Again, these are going to be cherished for years to come. Some other basic things that you can do: offer to help with various to-dos, such as babysitting or taking clothes to Goodwill or the like, maybe offering to sort through a loved one's things or maybe care for pets. I know that people are going to be very different in how they feel about this, and so it's always good to ask. Just offer. Just tell them, hey, I don't know what you have in mind, but I just want to offer. But when my dad passed away, a lady that had lost her husband came to my mom and said, if you would like someone to take Daniel's clothes and just get them out of the closet and take them to Goodwill or wherever you would like for them to be taken, I'd be more than happy to do that. And my mom was like, thank you. And so she told my sister and I, this was only a few days after he died, she told my sister and I, you need to go and get anything that you think you might want as a keepsake of your dad's clothing, because she says Miss Marcia's going to come and she's going to just gather everything up and take it, because that's what I've asked her to do. And I said, okay. And we went and got what we thought, you know, we might want to keep for the rest of our lives. And then the lady came and took them all away. For my mom, that was just a huge load off of her shoulders. Now, my son's clothes, I don't think my wife has gotten rid of anything that my son ever wore. She's kept every single article of clothing. Again, different people are going to feel different ways about that sort of thing, but it might be helpful to offer to them, would you like some help going through some of this stuff? Again, that can be very, very helpful. The biggest thing that I want to leave you with along these lines is you need to make yourself available to listen. You need to make yourself available to listen. This is perhaps the biggest thing you can do for a person who is grieving, and it is because the offer of, please let me know if I can do anything to help you, or I'm here for you, that offer is made up one side and down the other, and yet very, very few people actually mean for that favor to be called in, or very few people expect or hope for that favor to be called in. I ran into this when I lost my dad. Again, so many people had said, you know, hey, I want you to know I'm here for you if you ever need to talk, and then when I needed to talk, they always had something else they needed to do. Well, I've got to study tomorrow for a really big test, or I've got an intramural softball game, or I need to wash my hair tonight. You know, there's a million and one excuses. The people that were willing to sit and listen to me dump my toxic feelings on them, they became some of my closest friends. It was Jeff's daughter that was willing to do that, and that's how I got to be close with him. Okay, so again, you will never know just how meaningful you will be to someone if you make yourself available to listen. Before we end this session, what I would like to do is open up the floor. I would like for you, if you feel comfortable doing so, share with me two things. One, share with me some of the stupid stuff people said to you when you lost a loved one. And the reason I do that is because this is very cathartic to bring these things out to the surface. Some of these things you might have buried and been very resentful or hurt by. Let's bring these out to the surface. Let's get this out. Let's have a good chuckle at how dumb some people can be. Let's talk about these things. But also, you know, don't use names, don't use places. But I also see it as a way of reminding us that a lot of times our words most often hurt rather than help. So share with me some dumb things people have said. I like hearing these stories. But also, what are some things that people did or said to you? What are some things that people did for you in the aftermath of a loss that you found to be very helpful? What are some things that people did for you that you found very helpful that you were blessed by in the aftermath of a loss?
Michael, I've heard a lot of the things that you mentioned already, the same things, but I think one of the things that's hard to process to people that are grieving is when they attribute this to God. Like we had a little, and it's nobody here, but it was, I don't know, Leighton Haggard was probably maybe 8 years ago, I would say. About a year and a half, and he was shaken and went brain dead, and Kelly and I were called upon to be there for this family, and a lot of the people would say the same things you mentioned, but there was one person that, and I don't remember exactly how it was worded, but they attribute that situation to God, that God did this.
Mm-hmm.
That's a difficult thing for people to process in a moment mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
God would make something like that.
Yeah.
So I know that's one that's really difficult.
And at the same time, you know, if it's the grieving party that's saying, I just don't understand why God allowed this to happen, or I don't know why God did this, I'm not going to stand there and correct them. Because let's face it, some people say, we all say any number of things when we're hurting that we don't actually mean, that we know that are not actually true. I don't see the point in correcting them. That's not the time. Yeah, but you're exactly right. When people start attributing stuff to God, I'm just sitting there going, you don't know what in the world you're talking about. Yeah.
Not the family itself.
Right. Right, exactly.
Some kind of comfort.
Exactly.
How that's going to comfort.
Yeah, yeah. Very good. Somebody else. Yes, sir.
I lost a nephew, 9 years old. It was 20 years ago. I got a telephone call about midnight that he'd been hit by a car. And my sister-in-law called me. Asked me to pray. Then about 3 o'clock in the morning, I got a telephone call that they'd taken him off life support. And anyway, I didn't get a bit of sleep that night, but I had some good friends who are from the Metroplex. God, I love to death. Next day or so, we were talking, and I understood the source, and I mean, nice guy. And he says, you know, your brother can always have another kid. I mean, that's true. But you know, when you've lost a kid, you're not going to, I mean, they're special, and you're not going to replace them. You know what I mean? That there's, you know, sure you can have another kid, but they're not going to be like the one you lost. And the one that you get is going to be extremely special, too. You know what I mean? But just some, you know, and I didn't hold it against him or anything. He was trying to be helpful.
So our only other child when Daniel was born was Audrey, my oldest daughter. She was 9 months when Daniel passed away. And about a month after Daniel died, accidentally, Michaela was conceived. That wasn't planned. Obviously, when people found out that we were expecting another child, a couple of months after Daniel passed away, they were so excited. And more than one person said to my wife something along the lines of, oh, that's so wonderful, your family's going to be whole again. Because clearly, going from two children to one children to having a second kid again just solves everything. I have a little bit of a window into what people are trying to say when they make those types of things. Oh, you can have another one, yeah. But I'm just sitting there going, it's not like I just wrecked my car.
Yeah.
This isn't the same thing, yeah. What else?
Some of the things they say may be true.
Right.
It doesn't mean it's right to say it in that moment.
And that's just it. Obviously, with maturity, and hopefully sooner than later, we all come to the realization that just because something is true doesn't mean it will be helpful. Okay. But for whatever reason, though, people's propriety seems to go out the window in times like this. Have y'all found the same to be true? People's filter, the whatever it is that filters what comes out of their mouth, for some reason that filter gets really relaxed when they come to the funeral home or similar situations. I don't know. The only thing I can blame it on is the pressure that they feel to say something and to say something profound. They desperately, and I've been this way, okay? I'm going to point the finger at myself, and I'm going to point the finger at all of you. we have all probably felt that compulsion that we want to be the person that says that one thing that just, you know what, he said that to me and it just lifted my spirits and it just changed my entire thinking and I was able to get over the loss that way. We want to be that person who said that incredibly wise, profound thing. I got to tell you that 99% of the time, that wise, profound thing does not exist. There is nothing, especially in the immediate aftermath of my son's loss, there is nothing that you can say that's going to make me feel any better. Most likely, you're going to say something that makes me feel a lot worse. And so that's why I tell people, I love you, I'm sorry. I love you, I'm sorry. Tell me how much you have loved me ever since we first met. Tell me how sorry you are. That's all I want to hear. I even know one preacher, he's buried his son, he told me flat out, he said, I don't even want to know how sorry you are. It wasn't your fault. You're not going to kill my kid. Just tell me how much you love me. I don't completely agree with that. I see where he's coming from, but I tell people, you can say, I love you, and I'm sorry. You say anything else, you're probably going to say something very hurtful. What else?
What about if you, I've heard people say, we're hurting, we hurt with you, or we hurt for you, or something to that effect. Of course, every situation is different, you know, but we're hurting with you.
See, when...
Does that take take it away from the person that's hurting you?
But here's the problem, and I'm going to take my tag off, I apologize. Here's the problem with that statement. Somebody may hear that and be very touched. They see it as an expression of sympathy or empathy. Another person could very well hear that and say, how can you? You have no idea what this is like. That could be construed as, I know exactly how you feel. When, how in the world could you know exactly how I feel? So that's why I encourage people just to say, I'm sorry. You know, you can say, I love you and I'm sorry, and in no way are you communicating to that person, I know exactly how you feel. And that's why I'll say to them, I don't know exactly how you feel. I know enough to know that this is a terrible thing. I'm so sorry.
My brother who lost the son, during this period of time, I mean, he took it rough, him and his wife. Their family was everything to him. Where he works, the place he worked, there was a guy that he really didn't know very well, who had also lost his son. And he says, years later, he would talk about it. He said that he knew the guy and all, and through the course of him coming to the funeral, he discovered that the guy lost his son. But he said, after Jared was gone, and when the reality really hit in, everybody's gone home, nobody's there, and I mean, it's devastating. And he said that ever so often, that guy would show up at the shop for his business, and he said he wouldn't say a word, he would show up. But he says, you know, looking back now, he says, there's no doubt in my mind why he was there. He said he was just like, ever so often, he'd show up. He said that really helped out.
What are some things that people have done for you in the aftermath of loss that you found helpful?
I just lost my brother. But still in the process of dealing with his estate. And so basically been as busy now as I've ever been in my whole life. So there's been people that have helped. And
deal with some of the issues related to the estate.
Yeah, he left me very, very busy. Extremely. And, so just,
and
just
their help usually probably is significant to you because you feel like a lot of stuff has just been dumped over your shoulders in addition to the grief you feel.
Yeah, there's been just a lot of physical labor. Mm-hmm. And more than what I can do. I mean, I'll be doing this time next year. It was just me.
That's a really good point that you bring up. I know as a minister, I got this from my dad. I offer to go to the funeral home with the family when they are making selections for the service arrangements and so forth. I stand in the background and I don't say a word. Most times, however, if I'm already there, they will ask me, well, Brother Michael, what do you think? And that's my opportunity to say, well, you can do whatever you want, but typically what is done. And for them, it's helpful to know what's traditional, what's normal, what's usual, and they just want to go with that. Sometimes I'm able to steer them away from something that's clearly a money grab by the part of the funeral home I live up. I don't know that that's ever necessary. I've never actually seen that done. I've never seen a funeral where they did that. You can do whatever you want, but sometimes I can help them in that way. I know when my dad passed away, he did not have much retirement, but he had a life insurance policy. And my mom not only did not know what to do about cashing that in, but the guy that he had gotten the policy through, the insurance agent, he went to church with us, he just told my mom, I'm going to take care of all the paperwork. Once the money was received, my mom had no idea what to do with it as far as investing, et cetera. We have a family friend, and she's a very savvy financial planner. She sat in with my mom on all the meetings about, visiting with different people about what her options were financially to do with that money. It was a huge load off of her shoulders. So, yeah, I can easily imagine that's a huge help to you. Because that can be especially if you've never done that sort of thing before, I'm assuming you have not. You've never had to deal with the estate of somebody. Okay. I mean, you kind of feel like you're drinking from a fire hose a little bit, in addition to the grief that you feel, because I can imagine that can be very, very helpful. Anything else before we take a break? All right, let's take a break until about 6 o'clock, and then we'll come back for our last session. Oh, it is 6 o'clock. Excuse me. Let's take a 10-minute break and come back at 6:10.
Thank you.